Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Today we're going to be talking about a study from MD Anderson Cancer Center down in Texas, one of America's foremost, most respected cancer research and treatment centers. It's all about something that I've shared many times with you, and that is, what is pro-inflammatory, which can exacerbate all medical conditions, especially cancer, Alzheimer's, dementia, arthritis, diabetes, heart disease, atherosclerosis, and arterial sclerosis, and what is anti-inflammatory as far as healthy foods, a lot of raw foods, a lot of fresh foods, a plant-based diet, proper supplementation. Well, they took a look at this and they wanted to ask a basic question. Can an anti-inflammatory diet plus supplements improve survival among women with cancer? The findings reported in the British Medical Journal of Cancer reveal a lower risk of death during a 13-year follow-up among women with cancer who used nutritional supplements and consumed a diet that had a greater anti-inflammatory potential compared to supplement users whose diets were more pro-inflammatory. There were 3,434 participants in the Women's Health Initiative dietary. Inflammation indexes scores were calculated from food and supplement intake and provided by the women during a follow-up invasive cancer diagnosis. They looked at these women 13 years follow-up, and what they found was the women who were consuming the antioxidants and the anti-inflammatory diet had the lowest death scores. In fact, there was a 53% lower risk of dying from cardiovascular disease, 42% lower risk of dying from cancer, and 32% lower risk of dying from all other diseases than those that were on the higher pro-inflammatory diet. Now, it's not new that a pro-inflammatory diet can help you prevent or lessen the impact of virtually 90% of all illnesses. We also know that even something as simple as the old folk tale of, if you got a cold or flu, have hot chicken soup, all right? Now the question is there anything in that chicken soup that could actually lower the problem of the virus? Turns out the answer is yes. An apple a day keeps the doctor away. Yes, there's lots of studies on apples and what's in the apple, not just the pectin, but all the phytonutrients and polyphenols. And this is what we're seeing, that a lot of the things that we were told was just common sense is actually based upon good science. So once again, those who took their vitamins, and vitamins like vitamin C and zinc and magnesium, calcium, and took the foods like a lot of fruits and vegetables, rich in antioxidants, rich in anti-inflammatory agents, like green tea, very anti-inflammatory. All of this made a difference, because when you turn off the inflammation in a body, the body has a chance to heal. But look at it like this. Let's look at the average person. A person is eating unhealthy foods. And I was just thinking about this morning when I was running out on my track. And it popped into my mind years ago, my best friend that I grew up with from age one, Tom Croft, great athlete, pole vaulter, quarterback on the football team. Let me share just one life experience that you may find in common. My buddy was set having his birthday. We were on the track. And we were working out together, slow jog. Now, my buddy's name is Tom. We grew up since age one together. And we had stayed friends for the longest period of time. And he was spending a couple years down here as the caretaker. And he no longer wanted to be working as a coach, and he wanted to give himself a little respite. Well, that morning I said to him, "You just hit a new birthday. Would you like to really get healthy?" And there was silence. And then he turns to me and he says, "Gary," he said, The answer is no, because I'm not you. I enjoy going down to the Waffle House every morning here in town and having my waffles and sausages and drink the coffee and smoke the cigarettes afterwards. He said, that gives me great pleasure. I enjoy smoking. It relaxes me. Can I get sick from this? Yeah, I could, but I haven't. You know, I've been a jock my whole life, been athletic, been a coach, worked out. So I think my odds are pretty good. And I thought, well, how much of an effort would it be for you to give up the foods? And I said, let me just explain it. And you can say, fine, I don't want to do it, in which case I won't bring it up again. But maybe you might see the reasoning behind it. I said, look at all the people we grew up with, went to high school and junior high and grade school with, and how many of them are sick? How many have died? And what is the one thing you notice every time you go back to Parkersburg? Everybody looks older, and they're not in shape. And by the mid-40s, they're really out of shape, got the pot bellies. And then they talk about arthritis and diabetes as if it's normal, because so many people suffer from it. But look at what they eat. Pizzas, garbage food, you know, all the macaroni and cheeses, all the processed carbohydrates, all the meat. And you know, growing up, it was considered a part of working class standards, your family and my family, you know, that when your mother went to the market, she would get a two-inch steak. That two-inch steak was about at least 16 ounces. That means that the family members who ate steaks, and each one would eat a steak. Generally, it was once a week, but otherwise it'd be pot roast and chicken and whatnot. You're eating, by today's standards, 220 grams of protein. Your body only needs, you need more because you're almost 6'5", but you'll need about 65 grams of protein a day. In one meal and one item, you're consuming 3 to 4 days worth of protein. That's toxic to the liver, toxic to the kidneys, but it's cumulative. Now you smoke, and you're smoking 2 to 3 packs a day, and you've been smoking as long as you were a teenager. You start smoking around 13, and you haven't stopped because everybody in our hometown smoked. Well, what do you think that's done is causing inflammation in the lungs and the heart and the skin? I said, so when you're eating the potato chips and the french fries, the things you like to eat, every single item you're consuming is causing inflammation. And that inflammation sooner or later will cause a tipping. And when you get the tipping, then you get the symptoms of a disease. And when the doctor says, oh, we're lucky we caught the cancer early. No, they caught it late. 20, 30, 40 years late. So when you're having the fresh apple juice or eating some fresh fruit, that is anti-inflammatory. So there's always this conflict in the body between the things we love, the things we feel addicted to, the things that give us our dopamine hits, that sugar craving. And then we take the sugar, the caffeine hit, that gives us artificial energy, and that's all pro-inflammatory. Versus what we do to turn off the inflammation and to allow the body to heal itself. I said, yes, you've been a really outstanding athlete, but that's only one piece of the puzzle. So, anyhow, I laid out my points, and he said, okay, I hear what you're saying, but it's still the same. I feel great, and I'm not going to give it up. And by the way, you're the only person I know who has decided to give up all this stuff, things that you might have liked or had, for something that, you know, is healthy but not necessarily tasty. I said, well, that's where you're wrong. I said, why don't you come up the house and I'll share my dinner with you. See how tasty it is. You've been to my restaurants. These were all gourmet vegan restaurants, the first in American history. And people love the meals. Not only do they look great, every dish came out of the kitchen was decorated, plated to look beautiful, but it was abundant. I always gave people enough food so they could take half of it home, brown bag it for the next day. I said it was all healthy, all vegan. Okay, he said, but you got your way, I got my way. I said, fine. And that was it. I never brought that up again. 4 years later, he died of both brain cancer and lung cancer. And would he have changed? He was still smoking up to the very end. Because we get addicted to the foods that give us some sense of pleasure. And I just want to share this with you because in this case, it is frequently what we do before we get sick that will determine if we get sick and to what degree. The lower your immune system, the more likely you are to get sick from any number of conditions, and the worse that outcome can be. We've just seen that with COVID. The people most vulnerable of getting sick, being hospitalized, or dying were people over the age of 70 with multiple comorbidities. Well, the average American today is very unhealthy. Why can't we have a dialogue, just a civil dialogue, looking at the independent peer-reviewed literature in PubMed and ask, what does it tell us? And it tells us that we are intentionally choosing items every day that cause disease. Now, if we did it in other parts of our life, we would get a wake-up call. We would stop in all likelihood. But this is about something that everybody needs, food and our desired taste. Well, where do those desired tastes come from? Conditioning, advertising, the whole propagation that, a dietitian knows best. Well, I'm a registered dietitian, and I can tell you from my early training, including the residency I did of almost 1,100 hours in a commercial setting, they're the most unhealthy people I know are dietitians because they're still going along with food pyramid. You have to have meat 3 times a day. You don't have to have any meat. And you have to have dairy, and you don't have to have any dairy. But if enough times over a period of 60, 70 years, you're conditioned to believe that what you see on television and what you hear from so-called experts is right, it's easy to understand how people have made wrong decisions. So look at it like this. The average American, that's about 93% of Americans on a daily basis, consume through liquids, through sedentary activity, through diet, pro-inflammatory elements that cause inflammation. And the more of these you do, the worse it is, the worse the outcome. So where is our Surgeon General, where is our National Institute of Health having a dialogue on what would be the best diet? What would be the best lifestyle? Shouldn't we have people that have a little alarm on their clock that every 2 hours it rings once and, okay, stand, stretch, go for a little walk. And how about after a meal? Go for a walk for a half hour. That'll help level off your blood sugar. Yes, when you take a half-hour walk at a fairly good pace, not racing, after a meal, that brings down the glucose level. That's extremely important for diabetics and pre-diabetics, of which there are now probably about 100 million. That's terrible. And we have the same thing in children who are following their parents. So we've had 3 generations who've been given wrong information, and yet very few, only about 7%, are putting the pieces together each day. And it's not from the media, because there's no good information there, but from their own independent research showing they should exercise, and they should meditate or do yoga, and they should eat a healthy plant-based diet, and they should do intermittent fasting, not eating after dinner until the next morning, and taking 1 day a week, preferably on the weekends, and juicing throughout the day, but no solid foods. All of this is supported by the scientific literature that prevent disease and lessen the impact of a disease and live a longer life. That's what this study is showing. Now, how many oncologists and how many hospitals will now change through their dietetic department and give classes to every single cancer survivor of what they should do now that could help prevent that from relapsing in the future to live a longer life? This study shows that it works. All right? This has got, when you can reduce your risk of dying by 53% from cardiovascular disease and 42% lower risk of dying from cancer, I think this makes sense. But this will not be shared. This will not make it into the average person's mindset. Because, let's face it, people in the health field, from Nobel-winning scientists to triple board-certified physicians and nurse practitioners, they're human. They're susceptible to advertising and social conditioning and peer pressure. So they're no healthier than the rest of the public. So the information is there on anti-inflammatory diets and supplements, but we're not going to apply it, unfortunately. Now, one thing we may apply, but not because it's going to be healthier, but because we like it, is dark chocolate. I've given probably 50 reports on the healing health benefits of dark chocolate. Not a lot, like 1 ounce a day is fine. Well, from Kingston University in the United Kingdom comes a study that dark chocolate, meaning 70% or higher, can boost the time trial performance of cyclists, which means that would help any athlete improve. And why? Because the flavanol-rich dark chocolate is known to boost endurance and exercise performance in moderately trained cyclists. That's the new study. And we're only talking about 40 grams of chocolate a day. 28 grams is an ounce. So you're talking about still under about an ounce and a half of chocolate. That's not a lot. And it really improves cardiorespiratory fitness and endurance capacity and time trial performance. So, something to think about. So at least, and this was published in the Journal of International Society of Sports Nutrition. And one of the reasons that our running club has had so many elite athletes who are still racing and competing, Sam Skinner, Thelma Wilson, Sid Howard, myself, is because we are holistic, natural living, walking, running club. Others have got great athletes, but it's all physical. Ours is mental, and ours is energy, and ours is keeping our immune system strong, not overdoing it. So we've sustained it. From the University of Hong Kong, physical activity interventions to alleviate depressive symptoms in children and adolescents. We have a lot of people today, because of COVID lockdowns, who are depressed or anxious. In fact, depression is the second most prevalent mental disorder among children and adolescents, yet only a small proportion seek or receive disorder-specific treatment. And physical activity interventions hold promise as an alternative or adjunctive approach to clinical treatment for depression. Diet makes a difference. I wrote a whole book on it called The Food Mood Condition. In fact, I did a special. It was on PBS stations around the country. I had a whole panel of 12 board-certified mainstream physicians saying the same thing. When a person changes their diet from a junk diet to a healthy diet, their moods improve. I did a clinical study. It was one of some 56 clinical studies I've done. It was published in the peer-reviewed literature. I took 500 individuals, and to get into the study, they had to prove with a doctor, whether it was psychologist, psychiatrist, or their internist, saying that this person had clinical depression, was on these medications for at least 3 years, depression or anxiety. We met at a church on 86th Street in Amsterdam, and it was in the summertime. We did it for 3 months, June, July, and August, and turns out there was no air conditioning in the church. It was hot. But there we were, Luan Panisi and John Q showing exercise, and I would bring in different experts to talk about different areas of this, and I talked about the lifestyle and behavior of it. We would take people another block down to Riverside Park and show them power walking. We bring in hand weights and show them stretching and lifting to condition their muscles. At the end of the study, we had, and we filmed this, by the way. I've never shown it. I should. I've got so many films backed up that are done, but unfortunately, I just keep doing more films. I'm working on finishing two right now. And we had two come out last year and two the year before. And uh, what we had was 94% success. What do I mean by success? Meaning that we followed the people for 1 year. 94% of the people who presented with depression, clinical depression, or anxiety disorders, including bipolar, no longer had any symptoms and were feeling normal and excellent compared to the previous state. We had them do all these blood workups, and we had nurses taking blood pressure in every single meeting. So a lot of activity went on during that period of time. And yet, the larger world community, even though I talked about it, I gave my results at a scientific conference, nothing changed, except for the people who were in the study. So just the takeaway is, yes, you can reverse depression and anxiety by changing your consciousness, your perception, and your diet and supplementation. And we've done it. Remember, if you see 15,000 UFOs and they're all except one is shown to be weather balloons, but one is real, then they're real. But when you have 500 people in the largest study of its kind with the best results we can find in the scientific literature, and nobody pays attention. So that's why I shared this information with you, with the hope that you will begin to appreciate that if you have any form of disorder, that maybe you should look at some of these more non-invasive interventions, because they hold a lot of promise. So that's what this study showed. Again, this study, just so you're aware of it, it showed that physical activity interventions alleviate depressive symptoms in children and adolescents. And they've been really adversely affected, having to stay home, not being able to relate with people, having a mask on, not being able to relate. So it's taken a toll by any measure. So that's important. And finally, from the University of North Carolina, children who frequently check social media face significant brain changes. This is from University and Chapel Hill. Go to GaryKnoll.com to keep up to date on all the articles. I published 57 last year. I intend to even write more this year on a wide variety of topics. And also go to PRN.live to look at all the wonderful hosts, extremely talented, sharing insights and information, looking for the truth. And it's free. Tune in. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm sure most of you have heard that over the weekend, the Buffalo Bills NFL team had one of its players, 24-year-old gentleman, who had a heart attack. And they canceled the game. You could see great compassion, great concern on everyone's faces. But then something interesting happened. The next day, all over the American media were so-called experts and commentators saying that this could not have been from the vaccine. Really? We don't know what it was from. So why are you saying it couldn't be from the vaccine? But they were all certain, and they were all speaking as if they were speaking with one voice. How's that happen? But that's what they did. I would have thought they would at least waited till there is some forensic input that tells us what the likely cause was. But they didn't. But here's what you should know. You could do this for yourself. I Googled number of professional athletes. We're talking about professional athletes who die worldwide from heart attacks each year. And the number was around 37. Now that's from 1966 to 2004. More or less over 40 years. Now, from the vaccines till now, 1 year, you have 1,700% increase in heart attack deaths in 1 year. How's that possible? You wouldn't then examine that to see the association. So if that's athletes having that, how many extra people are dying of heart attacks myocarditis, etc., strokes, due to the vaccines? We don't know. We do know we have an enormous spike in people dying from unknown causes, but there haven't been the autopsies to determine the actual cause. But almost all those are from heart attacks. So we have unknown causes of death going anywhere from 10 to 40% above normal. Those are huge numbers. Those numbers alone mean that more people have died now from unknown causes than were dying from COVID. In Great Britain alone, it's over 220 per day from unknown causes. And yet the entire medical community and scientific community says it couldn't be from the vaccines. They can't prove that. Those are just specious theories. Where's the facts? So if this happens to a football player, and because he's a football celebrity, it becomes a concern for all of us, then what about all the people who are not famous? What about all the people who didn't die in a football field, but rather died at home from heart attacks when they had no underlying heart conditions? Here's a film. We're playing part three. The producer and director and writer of the film will be on next week. It's called Anecdotal. None of these people were believed when they had their adverse reactions. The doctors didn't believe it was from the vaccines. Why not? These are sometimes nurses and physicians themselves who ended up losing their career because of the adverse effects of the vaccine. Let's see what they have to say and why no one in the media, not 60 Minutes, not 2020, no one is willing to interview them or the doctors who have something to say. They could show a better light, like Dr. McCullough, or Dr. Pierre Corey, Dr. Cole. Now to the clip.
Before all of this happened to me, I had what I consider a dream life. All I had to do was just keep it going. I've lost my career, lost my health, lost my savings.
I am an unemployed paraplegic who's learning an entire new lifestyle. And the only thing I did between full health and my current condition is take a shot.
My life has dramatically changed after this adverse reaction. My career of 19 years, excuse me, that I took almost 14 years to train for is likely over. I'm just not safe to work as an orthopedic surgeon. Assuming the FDA and the CDC would be alarmed at my diagnosis, I expected to be contacted soon after my VAERS submission. No phone call, no contact.
VAERS is an early warning system to detect possible safety problems in U.S. licensed vaccines, co-managed by the CDC and FDA.
Not a single doctor I saw logged me in VAERS. All my reports are my own.
The other common theme is that they submitted a VAERS report, that they had to do it, and often their physicians didn't.
I then contacted the CDC myself. They acknowledged my VAERS submission, but stated my reaction was categorized as not serious, as I had not been hospitalized and I hadn't died.
I've had patients go to the hospital, and the hospital was like, this is probably from the vaccine. It was never reported. All the energy that's going to be put into reporting to VAERS, yeah. Is it going to count towards anything?
VAERS is a passive reporting system, meaning that VAERS reports can be submitted voluntarily by anyone. On the VAERS website, it states, under-reporting is one of the main limitations of passive surveillance systems, including VAERS.
Somebody called me. They said they were from CDC VAERS. And at the end of the call, they basically said, you won't hear from us again. This is merely for our reporting. And that's kind of how I was left.
Well, let's remember what VAERS was designed to do. It really wasn't designed to look at whether or not the vaccine caused an adverse event. For example, people choose what they want to report to VAERS. So there are some reporting biases and other potential limitations that don't allow VAERS to determine whether or not the reported adverse event was caused by the vaccine.
Although VAERS reporting is subjective and flawed, data can be analyzed as a way to note disturbing trends that may warrant careful attention. such as the fact that there are more reported adverse events for the COVID shots than for all other vaccines combined since they started tracking this data in 1990.
VAERS to this day has never called me. I have nothing. Give me something to do. Tell me how to get better.
People are asking for help, and the people who are in charge are like, you guys don't exist.
When I mention my reaction to the COVID vaccine, I'm met with silence. Rarely do people ask questions, unless they ask, are you sure it was the vaccine?
Let me be clear, I had a real adverse event.
My symptoms are real, and my life forever has changed.
When did the burden of proof become our responsibility? Shouldn't it fall on the companies or health agencies who are claiming their product is safe? And how do I prove it to you? What would you accept? The countless medical labs that show nothing? If you're wondering how to know if these reactions are real, I ask you, how do you know they're not real?
So much ugliness and bitterness from people who know just the surface of what's happened to me after this vaccine. It has become the loneliest and most isolating experience I've had in my 35 years of life.
We went to the emergency room and I insisted that they check his head. And that's when we found blood clots in his brain. His risk of death from one of those thromboses becoming a catastrophic event, some of the doctors have hypothesized it was greater than 90%. So we sat there in the ICU, basically hoping Everest would not die because there was very little they could do. They did tests on Everest from Black Plague to HIV. They tested him for HIV twice, and they never thought to look really hard at the vaccine. They really dismissed it. In fact, when I would push them, I actually had one of the physicians say, "Why are you being so combative?" And I said, "Because the symptoms started the night of his shot."
The doctors can't find anything wrong with you. So then they're like, oh, this must be psychological.
They even tried to admit her to a mental hospital.
There was a lot of questioning if I was crazy. Other people had the vaccine and they had side effects and they came back.
I could not wait to pee. I'm like, I just want to give you my urine so you see that I'm not using cocaine like they keep accusing me of.
I have been called a liar and a fake, and I have even been told by the ER doctors that this is all in my head. They called a social worker to have me evaluated and tried to have me committed to Western State Mental Health Hospital.
I have to fight to be believed and not written off as anxious.
Until public health authorities acknowledge these injuries, you can't seek treatment.
I was and still am pro-science and pro-vaccine. The main issue rests squarely on the fact that the FDA, CDC, and NIH refuse to acknowledge that real lives are being absolutely destroyed by this vaccine.
We all go in there thinking we're not going to be in that 1% of people who get harmed. But a lot of people don't know when it doesn't go well, you cannot sue. There's no vaccine injury hospital for you, and there's no one researching you. That small percentage is a terrible place to be.
I've had 6 spinal taps over 8 months, missed nearly an entire year of my life and part of my children's lives. My family and I are on the verge of losing everything we have. It was my understanding that the federal government accepted the responsibility of helping people injured by this vaccine, considering they gave the vaccine manufacturers full legal immunity.
You can't sue Pfizer, J&J, or Moderna for any of the injuries. You're relegated to a program called CICP, which has a standard of proof that makes it almost impossible to obtain compensation, and the amount of compensation is de minimis for the most part.
My doctor called me at home and wouldn't give me an exemption. And she said, but I believe you had an adverse reaction. I've been seeing you. And you should not get a second shot, but I'm not doing exemptions and I won't even report it was an adverse reaction, because that's how afraid she is that the medical board's gonna.
I've also asked my primary care physician for an exemption 4 times, and I live in Boise, Idaho. And yeah, the network there basically told her, under no circumstance are you allowed to get an exemption.
It has become de facto impossible to get a medical exemption for a COVID vaccine in the state of California. I received a letter from the California State Medical Board saying any physician in California who writes an inappropriate exemption will have his medical license subjected to investigation and disciplinary action.
Their licenses have been threatened, and because their licenses have been threatened, we cannot get medical care
I've seen emails where hospitals threaten their doctors. You cannot sign medical exemptions. You cannot talk about, you cannot report adverse reactions to these vaccines. And if somebody was actually brave enough to do that on writing, there were other people higher up to erase those. I have the proof and I have the people that have shown me these things.
But it takes a brave doctor to say, yes, if I believe my patient is having a reaction, I'll give them an exemption.
There is one other doctor that I know who's like, I'm gonna protect my patients. I'm gonna stand up for what I believe in. And everyone else is very afraid or has gone over here. And there's been a lot of shaming actually in the doctor community that I move around in. I'm here supporting my patients and what they need. And that doesn't mean that I'm telling people not to get the vaccine at all. I'm giving them informed consent. These are the pros and cons of the vaccine. This is the risk category that you're in. I want you to make the decision that feels right for you.
The ethical principle of free and informed medical consent, guaranteed by the Nuremberg Code, the Helsinki Declaration, was abandoned.
We still know nothing about long-term vaccine harms because the vaccines haven't been out that long. How can we possibly provide informed consent without this information?
You can't have informed consent if you don't tell your patients of the risks and benefits. When I emailed Army Public Health Command and asked about adverse events, the epidemiologist told me that they were not tracking, tracing, or monitoring adverse events.
I think at the beginning, the vaccines were probably working well enough to make it worth it. And I'm one of these that I'm willing to roll up my sleeve for science. You know, I understand that. I would have liked better informed consent.
One of the main side effects that we see is neurological. The reporting and the findings of the adverse effects, the publishing of them is very low. And that is in direct contradiction with what the healthcare people are seeing. And a lot of that is coming from this belief that global vaccination is better than the risk of these adverse events. But I would ask, how do we know that?
Public health guidance on this is crystal clear. Even if someone has already had COVID-19 and recovered, vaccination is the safest and most effective way to build a durable immune response that protects you, your family, your friends, and your community.
We were being told that the vaccine was the only solution, and anyone who questioned it was ostracized. But where did that leave people like me who weren't able to get fully vaccinated? Did I need to self-isolate forever?
Sobering. But it is the voice of the voiceless. They have no forums. They do not have anyone in the media concerned about them. Not the mainstream media. What do you think? I'd like to hear your thoughts now. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. We are plagued with disinformation. We are plagued with misinformation. We are plagued by lies from the mainstream media, from official government offices, and from corporate America. They all seem to be working together because they all seem to speak on the same topics in the same way, using the same words. Okay, they've told us all about Ukraine and why we must spend over $100 billion giving it to Ukraine with no accountability whatsoever, when we can't even feed Americans who are hungry, including having homes for our children, over 2.5 million who are homeless. We can't care for people whose medical insurance is gone now that the COVID program has been ended to supplement that. So what are we going to do for 15 million Americans who get sick? They have no one there to help them. And yet money that could help them, that could de-ghettoize America, that could bring industry back to America, that could help Americans, goes to Ukraine. How's that possible? Because we continue to get misinformation. But there are a few people. Scott Ritter is one, but Mr. Douglas McGregor is another, who tell us the truth, a truth that most Americans have not yet heard. He's going to give us his input now about Ukraine. You can accept or reject it, but I can assure you, if you fact check it, you're going to find his facts are more accurate than anything coming out of our Pentagon, Defense Department, or White House.
Well, I hear you, and we're all worried about that. And, you know, I've debunked what I'm calling the domino theory. Every time online someone says, Putin needs to be stopped in Ukraine, not on the Atlantic shores. I said, good God. I said, stop with the domino theory. That was dismissed after Vietnam. And I'm using the domino theory again, because isn't that what the opposition is using here, the warmongers? The
domino theory? Of course, it was used in Afghanistan. It was used again in Iraq.
Oh,
I listened to General Abizaid early on. If we don't stop these Islamists now, we'll be fighting them in our own country. Well,
I see. Same story.
One of my friends who was serving in Iraq at the time, he sent a message to me, just texted it to me, and he said, I'm trying to figure out how all these Arabs with their outfits on are going to get on boats and float over to the United States to threaten us.
Well,
he said, these people can't get out of their own way. Who are we kidding?
They could have taken El Al or...
this is the same crap over and over and over again to goad us into war.
Well, okay.
But this time it's really dangerous.
But you and I both agree that we want peace. The important thing for us to talk about is peace.
Absolutely.
And again, I'm a civilian talk show host. You are a military man, West Point, VMI, PhD in international relations from the University of Virginia. You led one of the largest tank battles in the Battle of 73 Easting, the U.S. Army's largest tank battle since World War II. I have to keep repeating that because people want to forget your expertise, and I don't forget it. It's just like they try to dismiss me as a nobody, and I won't let them do it online, and I won't let them do it to any of my guests either. We're not all equal just because we can all tweet. That's the problem, you know. So I'm going to ask you as an expert, am I correct in saying the reason we refuse to negotiate is because the military-industrial complex is one element, and the State Department with its primitive neocon, Reagan-esque view of Russia, are those the two pillars that are keeping this going?
I think that's a reasonable assessment. You know, one of the things that people don't seem to understand, and I include many people in uniform, if you go back to 1990 and 1991, you'll remember that we were already in the process of beginning to, quote unquote, downsize the armed forces, especially the Army.
Yes.
And Saddam Hussein did us an enormous favor. If he'd have waited a couple of years, we'd have been in a much weaker position to respond. But he did so in a very timely fashion for us. And it worked out brilliantly because we had an enormous amount of military power in terms of people and equipment and capabilities that were effectively a legacy of the Cold War. Well, today that legacy is gone. We don't have those surpluses of military power. We don't have a monopoly on all the precision strike, the space-based surveillance, reconnaissance, intelligence. All of those things lie in the hands of the Russians and the Chinese and Iranians and others now, particularly the Russians. And we're not prepared for an all-out war.
Wait, you're saying the Russians have a more advanced set of systems on those levels than we do?
Not necessarily more advanced, but they certainly have the equal of whatever we have.
So when this general on Fox News said that we'll take out their armed forces, what does he mean? You're going to B-52 bombing raids like in Vietnam?
Well, they won't last long because they stand an excellent chance of being shot down by integrated air defenses, something we don't have. We rely on the Air Force to shoot everything down with aircraft, and the Russians rely far more heavily on ground-based integrated air defenses. We don't have anything like that, and they can shoot down everything, including the stealth aircraft that we place so much value on.
What? The SS-3s, is that what they have? Is that what they're called, or they're more advanced?
No, well, you have the S-400s and S-300s, and the thing is that you have multiple levels and layers of air defense to deal with everything. And we don't have that. In other words, they can shoot down a drone as easily as they can an aircraft at 30,000 feet.
What's the maximum ceiling on their anti-aircraft?
I suppose it could go out to 40,000, maybe higher. It depends.
So
but the point is that they're in a position to shoot us down. Let's face it.
Now, what about the delivery of the Patriots? I'm going to give you a primitive viewpoint, my point. Again, I'm very cynical to begin with. So we're sending Patriots, allegedly a very complex system. It's going to take months of training in England or Poland, wherever. Are these Patriots that we're sending over somewhat obsolete now compared to what they're still very advanced?
They are up to the task of dealing with Russian aircraft and tactical ballistic missiles. That's what they were really designed for.
So they would stop an incoming nuclear weapon?
Well, I don't know that they're going to face any nuclear weapons, but I know that they can stop some, probably not all. I mean, first of all, we got to understand that we're talking about a battery, and that's perhaps eight launchers. And those eight launchers, each one can fire 128 missiles at a shot.
Interesting.
Now, when you start doing the math, it doesn't take very long to figure out that since you fire two missiles at every incoming target, you're going to go through a lot of missiles quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very difficult to build. We don't have a huge arsenal sitting there of missiles. So they're going to have to be careful what they use. Now, the second part of this, if you look at that entire aid package, we don't need to go through it all. Most of that stuff won't arrive in Ukraine for months. And the war may well be over by then on Russian terms.
Don't they have to bring those batteries in by rail or by truck?
One would assume so. And they'll be targeted as soon as they cross the Ukrainian border. They'll see them when they get off the railheads in Poland. They'll probably be shipped through Gdansk to the Polish border, where they're offloaded or put in some other transport and then moved. And I don't know how far forward they'll want to move them, if they're going to use them for military sensitive command and control sites, or they're going to put them around part of Kyiv. I have no idea. But it's still a point defense weapon. It's not going to defend a large area. In order to defend a really large area in a theater of war like Ukraine, you would need 10 battalions, not just one battery. So this is a gesture.
You know, as it's a gesture of support and to threaten Russia, that if you keep escalating, we'll escalate. We'll keep raising the stakes. We know they're playing a game of chips. So what is the tactical advantage to Putin to destroy Kyiv? Because I don't think he's going to do that. See, I think it's a feign. If I were a tactician, I'd make believe I was going to go for the capital of the nation. I would take out other targets instead. He doesn't want the bad PR, and he doesn't want to kill civilians. What's the advantage to Russia to take out Kyiv by saturation bombing?
None. And
the
first time the Russians went in towards Kyiv, it was a feint. People talk about the quote-unquote Battle of Kyiv. That's a lot of nonsense. It never happened. That was entirely designed to draw Ukrainian forces away from southern and eastern Ukraine.
Well, the State Department had said that they're going to invade Kyiv at a certain point. I remember that.
Well, I think that's the last option. In other words, what he's interested in doing now, what the Russian armed forces is being told to do in the next series of offensives that will begin sometime, I suspect, in late January, early February, is annihilate what's left of the Ukrainian armed forces on the ground. That's their mission. Dispose of them, eliminate them completely, and at the same time, stop the flow of weaponry coming into Ukraine from Poland.
Can they stop it?
Well, absolutely they can stop it, and they really haven't set out to do it in a complete military fashion. I mean, they can target the whole length of that border, and they can move forces up to that border if they need to.
From where?
Well, that depends on how they decide to do it. I mean, they have the capability now of attacking from several directions at once, or they can do it sequentially.
Right. Belarus would be one.
Sure, of course. They could come down from Belarus down south and put a force between Kyiv and the Polish border.
Oh, God. I'm actually sitting here trying to absorb all of what you're telling me, because you've given me some new information about the Patriots, the Patriot missile systems. And I think you said that there's eight batteries?
No, eight launchers in one battery. There's only one battery. Each launcher fires at one time 16 missiles.
So what's the total number? Are we sending them 1,000 missiles?
Well, I don't know, because I would say that we probably can't afford to send more than that.
No, you say one battery. I'm sorry, I'm doing the math. One battery, and there's eight what?
Eight launchers.
Eight launchers.
In one battery. President Cheney's office misinformed Colin Powell. Powell actually trusted the head of the CIA and the administration, and he forever had to live with the guilt that he misinformed people, and he so stated that. Well, this is his chief of staff, and giving us, you know, this, no, excuse me, that was a different person. But he's giving us what he knows, where the lies of the past are the lies of today. He's showing you what's really going on. And if you doubt me, look at the information that the mainstream media tells you, then look at what he and Scott Ritter are saying, and just say who's correct. But we are all, unfortunately, victims of this, because the money that's going to Ukraine could be going here to help. I just think of all the homeless children. I think of all the hungry children. What better way to spend money that the taxpayers are giving the government than to help Americans of all backgrounds who are in need? And there's a lot of us in need. I want to end today with a special. And I haven't mentioned my new book except once, and then we sold out of it. We just got more in today. It's entitled Rejuvenate with Juicing. And you get two DVDs with it. Now, mind you, this is no little small book, all brand new information. And I especially went into depth about why juice. What's in juice that you can't get in a regular diet? And so you understand the science, the enzymes, the antioxidants, the phytonutrients, the ability to help with thinning the blood, which prevents strokes, and help with your heart and help repair the arteries. Like pomegranates, when you juice that, you're getting nitric oxide improvement, and that helps in improving your blood flow, reducing stroke and the risk of a heart attack. But I go through all of this in depth, and I even given you menus and original recipes you haven't seen before, all brand new. So this almost 300-page book, beautiful cover, JR Art Director designed that. So Rejuvenate with Juicing, brand new book. It's not even in the bookstores yet. And you're getting it by itself if you just want the book for $19.95 at regular $24.95 plus shipping and handling, but also a better package for you where you're actually going to save $75, 65%, is you're getting the award-winning detoxification and natural approach, because if you're juicing, you're detoxing. So you should really know everything about detoxifying. And so detoxification, a natural approach, rejuvenate with juicing, all right? And it goes through all the basics and is a whole guide. And then the joy of juicing is a documentary. So you got a documentary, and in that documentary, you're going to see Dr. Joe Furman and Dr. Caldwell Esselin and Dr. Gerald Bondiker, a professor of public health policy at Columbia University, Dr. John McDougall, Dr. T. Colin Campbell, Dr. Jacob Gould Sherman, Professor Emeritus. I've got all these great people explaining why juicing is so important. It's a documentary. So you're getting a documentary, a brand new book, all new, and you're also getting a second documentary, Detoxification Natural Approach. What a package. Who wouldn't need it? Especially starting the new year. Do it right for yourself. And also for George in Los Angeles. George, get yourself a juice extractor, start juicing every day throughout the day, stay away from the sweets, stay away from the animal proteins and dairy, stay away from the refined carbohydrates, and see if some of those comorbidities aren't improved or gone within 3 months. Okay? So how do you get this great savings? You can buy the book by itself for $20 plus shipping and handling, or you can buy this whole package for only, you ready for this, $39.95, 65% saving $75. And all you have to do is call the order number. All right? And you can call, let's see, our vitamin closet and speak with Neil. He's there Monday to Saturday. And give him a call at 646-926-5430. Or you can order it online yourself. Go to GaryNull.com vitamin page, or you can call and Sandy or Diane will take your order at 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. And if it's not for you, give it as a gift. But everybody benefits from juicing. Everybody benefits from the advice given in the book and the two documentaries. Lots of good information to start the new year. And you deserve it. All right? Give us a call. 877-627-5065. We're out of time. Thank you all for taking your time. And by the way, whoa, I just did a pre-record, because he can't be there, with Dr. Corey for this coming Sunday's webinar. Wow. I mean, wow, wow, wow. I'm sitting there just absolutely mesmerized. Can't believe all the stuff he's saying. I didn't know as much about his background until I knew basic background, but I just said, please tell us about yourself in ways that we wouldn't otherwise know. 3 board certifications, and a professor in a college, a university, and primary care, working in the emergency rooms. And he had the integrity and honesty to say that he's lived in a medical scientific bubble, because he's both a scientist and medical doctor, his entire career, over almost 30 years. But now he's opened up to the complementary and alternative approaches. He was giving me the protocols step by step and really in depth. This is, in my opinion, this is going to help a lot of people. People with long COVID, yes, he directed specifically, but in detail. People who've been vaccinated and now have side effects, yes. People who were not vaccinated but have COVID and wanted to help themselves with that, yes. And people who were naturally immunized, then got vaccinated, yes. So anything and everything involving COVID, he's got the protocols, and he cites the science, and he cites the peer-reviewed literature, and he cites examples all over the world. He's interconnected with all these doctors all over the world. So he will now be a part of our panel. So we just added another hour on to, it's a long day coming Sunday. Go to GaryNall.com to sign up, or you can call that same number and sign up. It's only $30 for what will be at least 8 hours. It's a whole day, but we're going to have breaks throughout the day, and we'll have a little break for dinner. So, you know, so you can be a part of this. So call 877-627-5065. We have room for 21 more people, but that's as far as we can expand on getting you in on Sunday at noon for what to do with protocols on helping yourself. And these are the best protocols I could find in the world from qualified people. Have a nice day, everyone.